studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, October 5th, 2015. In the wake of the Oregon shooting tragedy, we'll hear today about a study on mass shootings and the availability of guns, and a look back at Arne Duncan's tenure as Secretary of Education. Plus, author Annie Jacobson joins us to discuss her new book, The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's top secret military research agency. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's breaking news headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
The Obama administration is enjoying a major victory with the announcement of a new trade deal with 12 nations known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Aimed at bolstering U.S. economic dominance in the face of China's spectacular growth, the TPP faced huge opposition from progressive groups who have cast the deal as, quote, NAFTA on steroids. Recently, Congress voted to give the president so-called fast-track authority over the deal, meaning that they would not be able to amend it, simply cast an up or down vote. A vote is scheduled for early next year, as Mr. Obama finishes up his last year in office. The TPP sets corporate-friendly rules on such aspects of the economy as pharmaceuticals, energy, agriculture, and the internet. One group of activists was apparently happy with the shape of the newly reached deal. Wildlife conservationists praised the deal that many had a hand in crafting. David McCauley of the World Wildlife Federation told the New York Times the provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership go beyond what we've seen in other trade agreements. Christina, what does this deal represent for the U.S. economy? Should workers be very frightened?
Well, we know that the deal is going to tie together about 40% of the world's economy, and that's from Canada and Chile to Japan and Australia. So, and we know that most likely much of that will go to multinational corporations, of course. We also know that the deal is one way that the U.S. is trying to kind of build against China's economic influence, right? So to allow the U.S. and its allies to set the standards for Pacific commerce instead of China, which is interesting in terms of Obama's kind of recent wanting to do this pivot toward Asia and move away from the Middle East. And so at the same time, we see something that's different, which are these environmental restrictions that you've just mentioned. But again, all of this taken into kind of into light is that, as we've seen in the past, these neoliberal trade deals often have lots of unintended and intended consequences, right, that ultimately benefit multinational corporations, as we saw with NAFTA, which is probably why they're calling it NAFTA on steroids. And so it's benefiting these corporations while worsening the economic conditions for the general public in the United States and abroad.
U.S. forces in Afghanistan bombed a hospital in Kunduz run by Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, killing 22 aid workers and 10 patients, three of whom were Afghan children. MSF denounced the strike, saying that they had given the hospital's coordinates to all sides ahead of time to ensure it would be spared. Kunduz is the site of a major battle unfolding between the Taliban and U.S. and Afghan forces. The U.S. was likely acting on the word of the acting governor of Kunduz, Hamidullah Danishi, who insisted that the hospital was being used by the Taliban as a base. But MSF has maintained that, quote, not a single member of our staff reported any fighting inside the MSF hospital compound prior to the U.S. airstrike on Saturday morning. President Obama announced that a full investigation would be carried out, and U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter echoed him. A spokesperson for ISAF forces fighting on the ground told the Guardian newspaper, quote, the strike may have resulted in collateral damage to a nearby medical facility. MSF has angrily denounced it as a war crime and said that, quote, relying only on an internal investigation by a party to the conflict would be wholly insufficient. Christina, how much of an indication of U.S. failures in the Afghanistan war is this horrific airstrike?
Well, it's definitely another example that continues to show that the U.S. wars in the Middle East in general are just not working and haven't been working for a long time now. And so we have two issues. We have thousands of civilians who are dying. We have thousands of civilians who are being displaced, as we see with the current migration issue as well. So, and this is all due to U.S. military intervention in the Middle East since the 9/11 attacks. So you know, this isn't anything new. We've been knowing this since the U.S. began this war from afar with drone strikes, et cetera, where certain airstrikes, you know, this is dominating military strategies. And unfortunately, we're just not getting enough attention from the public. So it seems to me that we've almost become numb to this news, right? So it would be even more disaster to come to the Middle East in the future as well.
And finally, South Carolina has been struck by historic rain and flooding over several days, fed in part by moisture from Hurricane Joaquin. The torrential rains have broken records. At least 8 deaths have been reported linked to the flooding, 3 of which were of people being trapped in their cars in the rising waters. Schools and businesses remain closed today as state officials have declared an emergency. Millions of South Carolinians and more than half the state have been impacted. Hundreds of roads and bridges are closed and many have been damaged. Water lines have broken and thousands have lost power. National Guardsmen, police and firefighters have been engaged in search and rescue operations all weekend. One meteorologist told the Associated Press the flooding is unprecedented and historical. In 2013, a local paper reported that South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and others buried an official and comprehensive report on the looming impacts of climate change to the state. Christina, do you think that Governor Haley and other Republicans will finally start to take seriously the impact of climate change when their own states are deeply impacted?
Well, I think the simple answer here is no. You know, based on evidence from other states like Florida and Louisiana, et cetera, I'm sure we can name many. We know that Republicans refuse to seriously address climate change, even when their states are being directly impacted. You know, not too long ago, Naomi Klein argued that the aftermath of natural disasters often favor politicians and corporations, as neoliberal policies are exacerbated during moments when the population is vulnerable. So I wonder whether we will continue to see that happen as climate change continues to be an issue, and it will, because it will get worse. There seems to be less urgency for Republicans to implement laws that would actually help curtail those effects. And so, as Naomi Klein just recently put it this morning, you know, we need urgent actions toward climate change as if the world depends on it.
Thank you so much, Christina, as always. My guest is Christina Mislan, Assistant Professor of Journalism Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. 4 miners were arrested over the weekend in Tuolumne, a town 120 miles east of San Francisco in California. The teens, who were all boys, are students at Somerville High School and were suspected of plotting a mass shooting at their school, similar to the scope of the recent tragedy at Umpqua College in rural Oregon, where 7 people were killed by a Southern California-raised white man named Chris Harper Mercer. The Oregon shooting shocked the nation just as so many other mass shootings have. The gunman, who killed himself in the course of the shooting, apparently left behind a note that was described by authorities as rambling with racial overtones. He reportedly asked people's religions before shooting them and was known to have sympathized with the Irish Republican Army. President Obama responded with strong words about the massacre. He spoke twice in as many days about the shooting, saying, "We've got to make a decision. If we think that's normal, then we have to own it. I don't think it's normal. I think it's abnormal. I think we should change it, but I can't do that on my own." Mass shootings in the U.S. are increasingly common, and while public support for gun control remains strong, the NRA continues to claim that guns don't kill people, people kill people. But a new study about mass shootings in the U.S. offers what its author calls empirical evidence that a nation's civilian firearm ownership rate is the strongest predictor of its number of public mass shooters. In other words, it is the guns. Recently on Uprising, I spoke with Adam Lankford. He's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Alabama and the author of the study on mass shootings. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's first talk about how you conducted your research. What data did you use? What did you leave out in examining mass shootings in the U.S., this ugly phenomenon?
Sure. Well, the goal was relatively simple, and it was to find essentially evidence of all attackers, public mass shooters from 1966 to 2012 around the world. And to build that database, I used the FBI active shooter report, the NYPD active shooter report, and a variety of international sources. I was specifically focused on offenders who killed a minimum of 4 victims. So that helped ensure that I was studying offenders who I could find, because there was clear records of them doing these horrible things.
And so yesterday's shooting wouldn't have qualified. There were 2 victims. A third was recovering in the hospital. However, the alleged perpetrator who killed himself did claim to be inspired by 3 at least mass shootings, one of which he said sort of provoked him to do what he did, the other 2 of which he said he sort of expressed an admiration for.
Right. So, you know, when you're doing a scientific study, you have to have strict lines about what counts and what doesn't. But the reality, of course, is that human behavior is more complex than that. You know, I think certainly behaviorally, this guy is very similar to the offenders I studied.
And I want to get to that, because you do sort of look at what drives mass shooters as well. Let's talk about how you came to the conclusion that the U.S. Compares well with other countries where there are lots of guns available. You looked at data from other gun-rich countries. Can you explain the sort of international context?
Sure. So basically, for 171 countries, I could find the firearm ownership rate. And I also looked at a host of other variables: homicide rate, suicide rate, GDP per capita, how urbanized different nations were. And basically running the statistical tests, you know, the tests themselves tell you what's significant. There's no subjectivity there. So the test showed that firearm ownership rate in countries, most kind of clearly the United States, which leads the world in firearm ownership rate, but also in countries like Switzerland, Finland, Yemen, Serbia, explain the high number of public mass shooters in those nations.
And actually, when you say the U.S. leads the world in ownership rate, do you mean that per capita we have more guns than another country, than any other country in the world, or just overall absolute number of guns?
Unfortunately, the answer is both. So we have more than 200 million actual firearms than the second highest country, and our rate is almost double the second highest country. So either way you slice it, we're number one when it comes to firearms, unfortunately.
More than Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, more than, you know, countries where there's more than the Ukraine?
Right. So these are civilian firearms. And yeah, we have more than 270 million in this country. The second highest country was actually India with 46 million. So you think India's population is much bigger than the United States, and yet the discrepancy in number of civilian firearms is tremendous.
So how did the U.S. compare in terms of the actual mass shootings? I understand that one of the things you found that was that mass shooters in the U.S. are likely to use more weapons when they go out and commit these horrific murders.
Right. So, you know, one of the things I did was model why some countries have more attackers than others. And another thing is look at the criminal behavior of these attackers. And as you suggested, one of the things I found was attackers in the United States are more likely to use multiple weapons. And all around the world, there's a correlation for these public mass shooters between using more weapons and killing more victims. Yeah, you know, it's a problematic scenario, and the attacker yesterday apparently only had one firearm. That may be one reason why his fatality count was a little bit lower.
What is there a reason why American mass shooters use multiple weapons? Is it just that there's so many guns that they're just doubling up?
I think so, and keep in mind that, you know, these are premeditated attacks.
Yeah.
You know, so often they're planning them for weeks or months, you know, sometimes even longer, and there's a sense of, particularly because there's a suicidal element for a lot of these offenders as well, that, you know, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory, that's the perception, and take as many people with me as possible.
One of the other differences you found that sort of surprised me was that the average number of victims killed by each shooter was actually higher in other countries than in the U.S. So that means the mass shooters in other countries that are fewer arms floating around per attack are killing more people than those in the U.S.?
Right. And so that might sound contradictory. Mm-hmm. It's actually not. In other words, everywhere you use multiple weapons, you kill more victims. But that surplus, that extra number of victims killed, was even higher in other countries. And I think what's going on there is a difference in law enforcement response. So we learned from incidents like Columbine. At Columbine, it took 3 hours for that scene to be resolved, and in the meantime, people were dying. So we've learned that these situations are active shooter scenarios. These shooters need to be made no longer active as quickly as possible because we've had so many attacks. And elsewhere in the world, they haven't necessarily learned that lesson.
Well, I'm wondering, just following from that, if the prevalence of so many weapons in the United States gives American police the excuse to arm themselves to the teeth and draw their guns whenever, even when people are unarmed. I mean, all they have to say is, I thought he was reaching for his gun, and we have so many guns that that excuse can hold water for juries.
Right. It's a tricky thing because you have some cops who are naturally trying to do the right thing, but may have legitimate fears because there's so many firearms in this country. But of course, that could also be used as an excuse. And it's hard for juries to disentangle, you know, the well-meaning police officers from those who might have more questionable motives or more questionable instincts.
Now, let's talk about the fact that you say this. You basically say that your study found empirical evidence that the more guns a country has, the more shootings there will be. Explain that to our lay audience. When you say there's empirical evidence, what does that mean?
Well, it essentially means it's not subjective, you know. So, you know,
I mean, this sounds obvious to me, Adam. Sounds obvious to me. It's like saying if there's more ice cream in my house, I'm going to eat more ice cream, you know. But if I just don't have it in the house, I won't get to eat it. So it sounds like an obvious thing. But, of course, the NRA doesn't think it's obvious, so you're trying to prove it.
Right. Well, the empirical part, though, is if the NRA sat down on my computer and ran the test, you know, they pressed the button, they're going to come up with the same result. So based on the history of 1966 to 2012, now, the future can always change, but it would be unprecedented for in the future us to have a lot of firearms and for this problem to suddenly disappear.
So many people cite the example of Australia and how reducing the number of guns dramatically reduces mass shootings, which, you know, if it's true that having lots of guns increases the likelihood of mass shootings, then the opposite should be true. What lessons are there to be learned from Australia?
Well, Australia reacted very proactively, or actually, I guess it's reactively, to a terrible mass shooting that killed 35 people there. And after that, they passed major gun control restrictions. They had a buyback program that reduced the number of guns in that country by 20%. And in the wake of those policies, they haven't had another public mass shooting since. So, I mean, I'm not sure we'd have that kind of immediate success in this country, but it's clear evidence that there's a reduction in firearms and a reduction in the number of attacks.
Hmm. Turning back to the incident yesterday, Vester Flanagan, the alleged shooter, in his suicide note expressed how upset he was at his treatment by his colleagues. He worked at the same television station 2 years ago. He said his colleagues were biased against him for being black and gay. And I want to quote what you said earlier this week before yesterday's horrific live television shooting that now seems so eerily relevant. Your statements were so relevant. And you said about this study before the shooting, in the United States, where many individuals are socialized to assume that they will reach great levels of success and achieve, quote, the American dream, there may be particularly high levels of strain among those who encounter blocked goals or have negative social interactions with their peers, coworkers, or bosses. That seems to be right on the mark. So basically, the combination of a lot of guns with what you call delusions of grandeur makes an explosive combination, literally.
Right. And when you add in the mental illness element, you often have these distorted perceptions where, you know, rather than handling adversity in kind of a humble or healthy way, these attackers usually are looking for someone to blame. And they have these distorted ideas that, you know, everyone's out to get me. Everyone's mistreating me. The attackers actually claim that they're victims themselves, and that's how they justify their violence. I'm a victim, and I'm just striking back. Hmm. But of course, that's not really what's going on.
But the NRA likes the idea, as does Donald Trump, who just this morning, you know, likes to fixate on, well, it's mental illness. We need to deal with mental illness and not guns. And they're trying to separate the two.
Right. Well, you know, I guess the fact is these public mass shooters are both mentally ill, in the vast majority of cases, and they have guns, you know. But I guess what I would say is, you know, what my study shows is there isn't a country in the world that has a tremendous number of guns and doesn't have this problem. So, you know, if the NRA thinks that that's, you know, some sort of magic solution, again, that would be unprecedented around the world.
I'm sure Australia has mentally ill people, but
right.
Not
and
mass
in fact,
shooters.
In fact, just to add to that, one of the other things I tested was suicide rates, and there is no correlation globally between countries that have high levels of suicide having some sort of high levels of public mass shooters.
Interesting. Well, Adam, where can people find your study? I understand you're going to be presenting it. Has it been published yet?
I presented it this week already at the American Sociological Association's conference. It will be forthcoming in academic journals. And I guess I just say, you know, stay posted for that.
Your website, would you like to give out that?
Sure. Yeah, people can keep track. My website is adamlankford.com.
Thank you so much, Adam, for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
My guest is Adam Lankford. He's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Alabama. He's the author of a new study on mass shootings. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has announced his retirement after a nearly six-year tenure. Duncan, who will leave his post in December, has arguably been one of the most powerful education secretaries in a very long time, creating his Race to the Top initiative, championing charter schools, and overseeing the adoption of the Common Core curriculum. President Obama sang Duncan's praises, citing a long list of accomplishments and saying he bleeds this stuff. He cares so much about our kids and is so passionate about this work. Obama has requested but not nominated Deputy Education Secretary John King Jr. to succeed Duncan. But many educators and parents have seen a worsening of the public education system in the U.S. under Duncan's leadership. My guest is Kevin Kumashiro. He is the Dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco and author of Bad Teacher, How Blaming Teachers Distorts the Bigger Picture. Welcome to Uprising, Kevin.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, the Atlantic magazine covered Arne Duncan's resignation with the following opening line. In a weird way, U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan's surprising resignation is good news for the people who want the beleaguered No Child Left Behind overhauled as soon as possible. So let's jump right into what's at stake in the near future over Arne Duncan's resignation before we get into his tenure. For many years now, lawmakers have attempted to try to reauthorize and or rehaul the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, also known as No Child Left Behind. What will happen to it now?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, both houses in Congress have passed their version of the bill to reauthorize this Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which means they're conferencing right now to come up with a compromise bill. But what we see in both versions of this bill is, I think, Congress's critique of current reforms that are being pushed by the Department of Education. So we see, for example, a move to weaken the Department of Education by taking away their ability to dictate how states are supposed to be using the test scores. They're not taking away annual testing, but they are taking away the ability of the federal government to say what stakes should be attached to those tests. And I think that's just one of the signs that and also one of the reasons why Obama might be reluctant to formally nominate the replacement for Duncan, because he's aware that Congress is really quite unhappy with this obsession with testing that is one of the signatures of the Duncan administration that would now be open for criticism and debate.
And so in what way did Duncan build on the No Child Left Behind policy that Bush pioneered and actually expand it?
Yeah, I mean, I think under No Child Left Behind, what we saw was greater attention to assessment, right? No Child Left Behind was really interested in us producing a lot more data that measures what's going on in our nation's schools and where are we falling short and where are the gaps. And what Duncan's administration does is it takes that one step further by not only increasing the amount of testing, but really dictating the kinds of testing and how we're supposed to use those tests. And in particular, what he did, especially under Race to the Top, is require that states adopt the Common Core and then attach certain kinds of decision making to those assessments. So we're making really high stakes decisions about student progress, about teacher evaluation, about school closure, and now they're even proposing to evaluate the programs that prepare the teachers, all based on whether or not we see gains in test scores. Even though I would point out that statisticians themselves, like the American Statistical Association, the American Educational Research Association, they're all saying that such use of these test scores is neither valid nor reliable, right? The tests, these standardized tests, were never designed to make those kinds of high-stakes decisions. They prove highly unreliable when we try to use them to make those decisions. And yet that has become the common sense of today. That seems to be the policies or the basis for policies that go unquestioned, really, by both political parties.
How have charter schools flourished under Duncan?
Yeah, excuse me. Under Duncan, what we see is, excuse me, a move to privatize public education. Race to the Top is a great example of moving from formula grants that target inequities to competitive grants that really privilege entrepreneurialism. And Race to the Top, what it basically does is it requires that states show how they're going to outsource in order to spend this massive amount of money. And charters actually fit into this larger agenda of privatization. Even though the birth of charter schools, right, the very beginning of charter schools decades ago, was really about empowering communities to shape their own schools and their own kind of destinies for their children. But that movement has become co-opted by those who believe that the public sector has failed, and so the private sector needs to step in. And what we see is, let's look at, for example, Duncan's legacy before he became the U.S. Department of Education Secretary. Before he was in this current position, he was the CEO or the leader of the Chicago Public Schools. And one of his signature reforms there is called Renaissance 2010. It was to close down about 60 or 70 so-called failing schools and open up about 100 smaller schools in their place. But what we often forget is that a year before he announced that initiative, it was the Commercial Club of Chicago that announced their plan for how we should improve or change the public schools in Chicago. And they were calling for closing down about 60 or 70 schools, opening up about 100 smaller schools, and they wanted those schools to be charter schools run by for-profit management companies. Now, although Duncan took out explicitly this part about privatization, what is the reality is that we have opened up about 100 smaller schools in Chicago, and they are the majority charter schools greatly run by for-profit management companies. We see this in New Orleans, we see this in Philadelphia, we certainly see this in New York, that charter schools has become the entry point for corporations to be able to have even greater impact on what public education is looking like.
And of course, charter schools then overall tend to undermine teachers' unions and really create this corporate model for education. President Obama was full of praise for Arne Duncan. What do you make of the praise that he threw at him? And overall, certainly, as I mentioned, Arne Duncan has been a very powerful education secretary, reshaping the education landscape much more than his predecessors. How well deserved is the praise? And does that essentially depend on which side you're coming from in the education debate?
Yeah, I don't know if many people would debate that Arne Duncan has been a very influential secretary. I think that is accurate. I think that under his tenure, we have seen some fundamental shifts, not only policy shifts, but arguably even ideological shifts in how we think about the problems and the possibilities for public education. And, you know, where we could debate is whether those changes are actually positive or negative, right? Because some people would say, oh, these are great changes. But others of us would say that the biggest changes that the Duncan administration has pushed for has transformed the landscape, but have actually widened the inequities in education. They've made things worse. Mm-hmm. So the obsession with testing, for example, has actually, you know, if you think about this irony of the current school reforms. What we see is that when schools are struggling, we tell them to do certain things. We tell them to take more tests and so to spend more time preparing for those tests, which means we need to cut out all of the other aspects of curriculum in order to hammer home on basic reading and math. And when we compare that with the top performing schools, they look nothing like that, right? The top performing schools are highly interdisciplinary, have very rigorous, locally developed curriculums. They not only spend less time preparing for tests, they actually take less tests. So when schools are struggling, the reforms under the turnaround school movement is actually making them look less and less like the top performing schools in our country. And that is why we should be very skeptical of the promise of this movement, right? We need to be asking ourselves, why are we continuing to insist that this is the path forward when it's actually making the problems worse?
Well, we'll certainly see how Duncan's successor takes on his legacy, and maybe we can have you back on at that time. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest is Kevin Kumashiro, Dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco, author of Bad Teacher: How Blaming Teachers Distorts the Bigger Picture. This is Uprising. When we come back, Annie Jacobson joins us to discuss her new book, The Pentagon's Brain. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. A recent headline in late September on the Popular Science magazine's website read, DARPA gives MIT lab $32 million to program living cells. DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, a secretive government agency that spearheads bizarre-sounding scientific research. And that headline was fairly typical of the type of project the agency oversees. On its website, it says DARPA pursues opportunities for transformational change rather than incremental advances. But the question is, what sort of transformation and why? While DARPA has been the subject of speculation by conspiracy theorists since its founding in 1958, no one has actually written a definitive history of the agency until now. My guest is Annie Jacobson. She is a journalist and the author of the New York Times bestsellers Area 51 and Operation Paperclip. She was a contributing editor at the LA Times magazine. She's a graduate of Princeton University, and her book is called The Pentagon's Brain: An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. Welcome to Uprising, Annie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to admit that when I first saw your book, opened up the envelope, looked at the title, I kind of immediately, for a second, dismissed it as some sort of possibly conspiracy theory-filled diatribe against the Illuminati and the government's secret agenda to control all our minds. And then I realized it was published by a mainstream publisher. And I opened the book and I thought, oh, this might be the real deal. How do people treat your book when they first see it? Do you get some skepticism?
You know, I think I have all kinds of readers, which is actually, as you know, the job of the journalist to inform the public. And so when you have readers on both sides of the aisle and from all over the planet, you get a sense of perhaps I'm doing my job, which is really to present the facts. And, you know, The Pentagon's Brain, it's sort of like a hot title, but in essence, it speaks to the fact that I write about these great minds that have been producing this radical science since 1958. They are, in essence, the Pentagon's brains, and then DARPA, that agency, functions as the Pentagon's brain.
So you spoke with more than 70 people, affiliated with DARPA, which is quite amazing. And you sort of stitched together this history going all the way back to the founding. And I want to ask you about the people involved, but first, the founding of DARPA. The story goes that the Soviet Union Sputnik motivated and the launch of Sputnik motivated the creation of DARPA. Of course, it was a little bit more complex than that. This was in the 50s. We had invented the atomic bomb. The Cold War was starting. And then there was this sense that the U.S. was falling behind, that we had to measure up to the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Tell us that story briefly.
Yes, well, it's very specific. I mean, when the Russians launched Sputnik, they had beaten us into space. And that caused, in essence, panic in America. DARPA was set up just a few weeks later, very specifically so that America would never again be taken by technological surprise, which is exactly what DARPA has done. Mm-hmm. So it really is a double-edged sword. I mean, they produce some of the most amazing science that finds its way into your and my lives, the internet, GPS, the list goes on. But they're also responsible for, and keep this in mind, this was the mandate of DARPA when it was created, to create vast weapon systems of the future. And that is a spooky idea. They are about weapons.
And initially, this started out as ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency. The D, the defense, was tacked on in 1973. Right after the Vietnam War, people were tired of war, and it's arguable whether that actually changed much about DARPA's approach. But how did the, how did DARPA get set up? Because I was really surprised at its structure. There are an unusually tiny number of people actually employed in this organization. It has an unusual degree of flexibility and autonomy that most government agencies do not have the luxury of having. It only employs about 120 people.
Those are called program managers, and you're absolutely right. So it has this lack of red tape, which makes it really unique and very effective. Consider this. DARPA's budget this year is $3 billion. Divide that by 120 program managers.
Oh my goodness.
You can see the power that each of those individual program managers have. They then reach out to academic universities, military laboratories, industry, and they create and build their programs with those very large budgets with extreme flexibility that you referred to.
So that headline that I mentioned, $32 million here, very likely many other universities and research think tanks getting tons of money. One of these, RAND Corporation, based right here in Southern California, has deeply been involved in DARPA research, but it was also involved quite early on in the start of this, in the founding of DARPA, right? Tell us the link between RAND and DARPA.
Absolutely. I mean, RAND was seen as sort of like the nuclear think tank. They were really, they helped the Pentagon calculate death numbers for nuclear war. And in the 50s, they had that reputation as sort of the dark thinkers. Well, when the Vietnam War came along, suddenly DARPA was involved, then called ARPA, was involved in all kinds of weaponry. I mean, conventional weapons, advanced weapons. For example, ARPA developed the Agent Orange program. And they also became involved in social science and anthropology, which on face you think, oh, well, that's interesting. But when you really look at it and you couple it with ARPA's absolute pioneering efforts in computers, you realize behavior was looked at toward a means of behavior modification, of behavior examination, of surveillance. And RAND absolutely took the lead. They decided amongst themselves, I write about this in the book, wait a minute, we must spread out from the business of, you know, nuclear death toll and nuclear think tank into, you know, a broader spectrum of work. And so they really, you know, took on a new level of thinking for the Pentagon starting in the Vietnam War. And of course, now they are in a huge position with DARPA.
And I want to get to where we are now. Let's talk about the people that you interviewed. How did you find them? 71 people involved and affiliated in various ways with DARPA. How forthcoming were they? How did you locate them?
People often say to me, you know, how on earth did you write about DARPA? They won't answer my call. And that is true. I often say DARPA's press office is really an advertising agency.
Right.
They have their own agenda. You read that incredibly lofty, beneficent quote. That is what DARPA does well. They promote themselves as this agency that is advancing science and technology for our benefit, which they are in part. What you don't ever hear from DARPA is this, you know, the other stories. And that is important that the public knows what DARPA has been doing for all these decades, the good, the bad, the ugly, the nefarious, the failures, the successes. You want to be able to, as a citizen, see brilliance and hubris. You want to see these revolutionizing moments in history, but you also need to see what has gone wrong and why. That's what I write in the book.
That's our money. Let's, you know, be so clear with this. And that was one of the things that made me angry when I read this book. You know, this, the luxury that these 120 people have to distribute $3 billion of our money to develop weapons, to develop advanced weapons, to be inspired by science fiction, and I want to get into that, and to have so little accountability, which is exactly how they want it, and which is actually what makes them set the trend. And one other thing that I thought about when I was reading your book is, you know, in the retail world, when Walmart starts doing it, everybody follows. In the world of military research, when DARPA starts doing it, I realized that everybody else in the world follows. And one of the questions around that is drone warfare. Can we thank DARPA, ironically, of course, for the invention of drones that are now being adopted all over the world by all other countries who go, wow, this is a great idea. We can drop weapons without hurting, you know, people ourselves, hurting our own people.
There's so much to learn in that specificity of looking at drone research with DARPA, yes. So it goes all the way back to the Vietnam War. How surprising is that to think drones were being used in the Vietnam War in 1968? And yet the American public didn't even, save a few military experts, did not even know about drones until they made an appearance on the battlefield in Afghanistan in October 2002. And think about this. At the time, we were the only nation that had armed drones in Afghanistan, okay? Today, 186 nations have armed drones. DARPA is so far along into other forms of robotic warfare because it must always stay ahead. It must always be the agency creating what the Pentagon calls revolution in military affairs.
So the Vietnam War, where it sort of pioneered biological warfare, you know, pesticide sprays to remove foliage and make it easier for aerial bombardment of the Viet Cong, which, of course, invariably led to mass, quote-unquote, collateral damage and Agent Orange, didn't that, shouldn't that have led to a serious distaste for this kind of research?
Well, it did. And that's the, you know, when you spoke earlier of how DARPA got its D for defense. The irony there is that when it was called ARPA, after the Vietnam War, ARPA got in a lot of trouble for doing what Congress saw as like unnecessary military research. And there was a mandate then to only start doing necessary defense work, hence the D for DARPA. But something exactly the opposite happened, which is that DARPA was moved out of the Pentagon. It was kind of banished a couple miles away, which was considered a demotion. But there's an amazing moment there where suddenly, left to its own, DARPA is able to pioneer science and technology as an industry inside the Pentagon, even though it's outside of the Pentagon. And so that's when you see this incredible buildup of drone warfare. It was something the Pentagon, or rather DARPA, called offset strategy. It's fighting wars from a distance, putting the drones in play, ultimately putting robots in play. And what you have now is remarkably spooky when you're looking at DARPA's plans, I think spooky, for what is called autonomous warfare.
Yeah.
Having the robots be self-governing, no longer controlled by a drone operator, but taking the human out of the mix and building, you know, into the robot a program to go be a hunter-killer robot on its own.
Okay, we are not talking about Battlestar Galactica here. We're talking about a U.S. government agency funded by taxpayer dollars. So this super soldier that you've written about, this future warrior, is something that really sounds like the stuff of science fiction. But in fact, DARPA has also, and DARPA staff have actually looked to science fiction for inspiration.
Well, actually, the DARPA director said just a few days ago at the Aspen conference, everything is science fiction until it becomes real. And that is exactly what DARPA is about. But you mentioned this DARPA programs that I write about to move us towards, you know, hunter-killer robots, but it is actually Pentagon dogma. Mm. And this was remarkable to look at these, yes, very thick 300-page documents, but anyone can read them. They are unclassified, and they talk about the Pentagon's position to move toward this kind of warfare. And people still think of this as something, you know, a way off, far out sci-fi idea, when in fact, when you realize, when you look at the history of DARPA, what DARPA says, it actually does. Mm. So those plans are in play. They're in play for 20 years in the future, but those machines are being built now.
So what is exactly the relationship between DARPA and the Pentagon? Let's talk about how it works. It's now, the DARPA is housed a few miles away from the Pentagon. Does DARPA set its own agenda and then turn over research findings to the Pentagon, or does the Pentagon give it assignments?
Well, that is a great question. It's an interplay. So the DARPA director reports to the Undersecretary of Defense. And at many times throughout history, you see the DARPA director reporting directly to the Secretary of Defense. So that's sort of like a hierarchy, but you can see that interplay. And by the way, you can also see how the DARPA director is working with the Secretary of Defense and often the President in times of war. So it is such a close hand-in-glove relationship. And on the outside, you have Congress. And when I say on the outside, I really mean that, because Congress is simply authorizing this $3 billion budget that the President requests and then goes back to DARPA. But by the way, that $3 billion is just the publicly known budget. There are always black budgets. We know that. And that is not reported. So the exact sum total of money that DARPA is working with is unknown.
My guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her book, The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. You point out in your book this very bizarre sounding group of scientists that work with DARPA called the Jasons. I mean, this sounds like the sort of nerd equivalent of Skull and Bones.
Well, if anyone listening is a conspiracy theorist, and I say that with, you know, I have a lot of readers who subscribe to that idea, and I always say they're not entirely wrong. Many of their facts are actually accurate.
Right.
It's just where it goes, yeah. Okay? But the Jason scientists are right up there with the Illuminati in many people's minds. I found quite the opposite to be true. I interviewed for this book Marvin Goldberger, called Murph to his friends, just passed at the age of 90. But he was the co-founder of the Jason scientists back in 1960, advising ARPA on the most complicated problems of science. The Pentagon actually called them the supermen of science.
So are they just some sort of a self-described, like a secret fraternity of scientists?
Well,
they invite a fellow scientist to join?
Yes, you must be
mostly
invited.
Mostly men, I'm guessing?
They now have one woman.
Ah, okay.
But they are mostly, at last count, they had one woman. But we're a little behind the public times. But, you know, they were primarily nuclear physicists and engineers in the beginning. But as I write in the book, after the wall came down and we learned about the Soviet bioweapons program, suddenly there was a whole bunch of biologists in the mix. And that really shifted things for the Jason scientists and also for DARPA.
How did DARPA adapt to a multipolar world after the Cold War ended?
With flexibility, again, giving credit where credit is due, suddenly DARPA had this whole new world it had to defend against, and it began to understand bioweapons, and also, not that it didn't understand them before, but it didn't realize the threat that was actually clear and present, because the Soviets were actually developing bioweapons and had an arsenal of them. And also, right around that same time, DARPA realized it had to defend against urban warfare. And of course, that is so much what we see now. One interesting DARPA document I came across was actually written by the RAND Corporation for DARPA, and it said, when it was talking about urban warfare and how we wanted to avoid it, the quote was from Sun Tzu, that Chinese military general from 2,500 years ago. And it said, it is the worst policy to attack cities.
The art of war, yeah.
So we have DARPA trying to learn how to defend against these urban warfare environments, not with great success. And of course, just read the headlines and see how that impossibility right now, DARPA has a lot of great minds working on how to possibly address that, because it is a big conundrum.
So right there, I think, is a really good point to discuss that despite all of this military capability, on September 11th, 2001, DARPA's technology did not save the United States. And all it took was, you pointed out, something like the whole operation of Al-Qaeda cost them less than $500,000 to hit the biggest, you know, most powerful, most militarily powerful country in the world. And in the end, human ingenuity that is driven by desperation and anger at the weapons that DARPA has delivered may often prove to be able to undermine the most sophisticated weapons.
And that's exactly what happened. But another important thing happened at that same moment, which is that...
And I don't mean to sound admiring of what they did, of course.
No, but you're making an absolutely clear, critical point. But there was a flip side of that in terms of DARPA, which is that suddenly the amount of money that Congress was willing to give DARPA to defend against that attack that you refer to on 9/11
that they failed to prevent
was bigger than any amount of money since Sputnik. Mm. And so there's a great irony, and also again that idea of the double-edged sword coming into play at that exact moment in history.
Mm. So you have these super soldiers now that inform the future of what DARPA's research is going into. And in a way, the weaponized drones are a precursor to that, right? Somebody sitting in a control center in Nevada can drop a bomb in Afghanistan without physically getting hurt. They might have some mental PTSD from, you know, from killing ordinary people, but they can remain physically intact and drop a bomb from many, many thousands of miles away. In the future, will we see, dare I say, weaponized ground troops?
DARPA calls them the dismounted soldier. And absolutely, DARPA has recently teamed up with Special Forces, with Special Operations Command, and is creating what the president called it was the Iron Man suit. He called it that in jest at a press conference in the White House. Mm-hmm. But in essence, that's what it is. And this, believe it or not, is a DARPA idea going back to the 1980s, the idea that the soldier's physiology and cognition needs to be enhanced, can be enhanced, and therefore should be enhanced by mechanical and other means. And that's where you get the soldier, the super soldier, both with a super soldier suit and also this idea of looking inside the body to enhance cognition. And there you get into some very controversial ideas. I write about this in the book about, you know, implanting neuroprosthetics, otherwise known as brain chips, in the brains, the soft tissue of the brain of soldiers. And that's a big debate that is presently going on right now inside the Pentagon, not as far as the public is concerned.
So is this research in development right now, in a development stage?
They're in clinical trials, absolutely.
It's gone that far.
Absolutely. And they're being used right now with veterans. So 2.5 million soldiers went to the war on terror. 300,000 came home with brain injuries. And those veterans with cognitive impairment are being used in these clinical trials to see if DARPA can have a program to, quote unquote, repair cognitive functioning. But there are also other issues, which brings me to this document that I found, again, unclassified, written by the Jason scientists who I interviewed, which warned the Pentagon and DARPA against this kind of research, specifically because, and these are their words, not mine, it could lead to high-quality brain control.
Wow. Did any of the people involved with DARPA that you interviewed express fear, regret, remorse for what DARPA has done and enabled and might enable?
On balance, no. Wow. The majority of scientists and engineers who work for DARPA are extremely grateful to be able to do what they do, which is push science. And they also talk about how many private institutions will not invest in what DARPA calls pre-requirement research. So right here in California, down in Irvine, I interviewed two scientists who have what is called a limb regeneration lab. They believe humans should be able to, and one day will be able to, regenerate lost limbs. Not just lost in the war theater, but, say, lost in an accident. The kind of research they're doing, very few people will invest in because it's 25 years out. DARPA gave them a multi-million dollar contract, which they were very grateful for, and were able to do, according to them, research that they absolutely would not have been able to do, progress that they could not have made without DARPA.
So is it fair to say that some of this research, of course, has some extremely positive impacts, but DARPA can always see a weaponized use for them, these dual-purpose research?
Absolutely everything is dual-purpose. Although for DARPA, I believe it has one purpose, which is to create the vast military weapons of the future. For the rest of us, it has a dual purpose. But consider this. There was one bit of remorse that was shared with me by the co-founder of the Jason scientist, Murph Goldberger. And it was curious what it was. Now, Goldberger worked on the Manhattan Project. He helped develop the atomic bomb. He had no remorse about that, believed that it won the war and saved lives. His remorse came from Vietnam, and he said to me, we should never have gotten involved in Vietnam. But in the bigger picture, his remorse came from the fact, he said, that he spent his life working on defense problems when he wished he had been pursuing pure science. Science for the fact of, ultimately, what he said was being one of those few who might do something important enough to be, you know, recommended for a Nobel.
You ask in your book, is it wise to let DARPA determine what lies ahead? Having written this history, what is your personal answer to that question?
Well, again, the job of the journalist is to inform the public.
Yeah.
With that said, because I write about nuclear weapons in the beginning of the book and the incredible danger that they posed and still pose, and I must, you know, remind myself and others that nuclear weapons cannot launch themselves. So the reason we have stayed, you know, outside of World War III is because they can't launch themselves. I do see a great potential disaster in artificially intelligent robots because they can launch themselves.
Yeah. Annie, thank you so much for joining us today and for your work.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Jacobson is author of The Pentagon's Brain, an Uncensored History of DARPA, America's top secret military research agency. You've been listening to Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm your host and executive producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. I'll see you next time.